Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning broadcast. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Oh, good morning to you, Nachum.
Does it bother you that Al Gore is doing business with Al Jazeera?
Well, the two Al's getting together is of concern. It's not that it's Al Gore, but that he sold his current TV network to Al Jazeera, whose past history certainly raises some concern, even though they are trying to assure people that this is meant to be a domestic operation and that they are, in fact, the ones who first introduced Israeli spokesmen and spokespeople to Arab audiences.
Right.
And recently had a lengthy interview with Shimon Peres and
right.
Mark Regev, the government spokesman, appears there regularly, to which there is some truth, but their coverage certainly has angered many people in Israel and in the Arab world. I know that I heard Arab leaders describe Qatar, which underwrites it, as a country built on a TV station. So, it's concerned.
Yeah, there is a concern. I was surprised that there wasn't more backlash. I thought as the media reported this, they would raise those concerns a little bit and talk about what criticism Al Gore and his partners might be under. But maybe, again, especially in the media circles, they feel it's more mainstream or closer to mainstream than I think.
Well, at first, Time Warner Cable, which is the nation's second, I think, largest TV operator, said it will drop current TV. And part of the concern always was that they gave Osama bin Laden the microphone in the years following 9/11, and this gives Al Jazeera access to about 50 million U.S. homes.
Right.
So the reason I think the response is muted is that there isn't much you can do. It doesn't seem to need any kind of official sanction or approval.
Right.
For this to go through, but people can vote by making sure that it's not carried,
right,
and by putting pressure on them to, and they have reached out to people or begun to reach out to try and assure them that this it won't be a propaganda base, but their past programming would indicate otherwise.
I know this isn't our focus for today, but I'm so curious since we brought him up, or I brought him up. So what's the book on Al Gore? You know, when we first started having these conversations on the air, you know, over 20 years ago, I'm sure you spoke about his relative dedication to the state of Israel when it came to Congress and, of course, his father as well. Now that we look backward, what is the book on him?
Well, in his years in Congress, he was a staunch supporter, and even as vice president, and something, I don't know, happened or it was a change, because he was certainly in the forefront of a lot of the efforts and was considered a reliable friend and advocate. And of late, you know, he either is hanging around with the wrong people or some transformation. I wouldn't say he's anti-Israel,
right,
by any measure, and he's not. But look, he's out there making money, and a lot of it.
Yeah.
He got a good price for the...
Why, money changes people, you think?
It certainly influences the direction which they go and their willingness to speak up for the right thing and take the right stand. But I think somebody had written that day, it would be good if TV channels carried, like cigarette packs, a warning about their content.
That's a good idea, actually. Oh, you know, there are some people that try to do that, that try to warn people what they're going to see or hear from certain media outlets.
Yes.
Not, and by the way, one of them is the topic that I wanted to bring up today. It's funny you mentioned that. There's a former candidate for governor in Arizona in a video that's certainly gone viral, at least in our community, who blames Zionists and Jews for everything, essentially. The guy's name is Michael Harris. We have quotes here about a Zionist-controlled Hollywood. You know, he blames the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, on an Israeli death squad that was sent to the United States or arranged by Israel here in the United States to kill American children for the express purpose that Israel was upset about what happened at the UN with the PA. Now, I know, Malcolm, that our reaction as a community, and I've heard this enough from people yesterday, he's a crazy man, lunatic, and all that, but you always tell us stay very guarded before you just throw out these terms and realize that there are a lot of folks who take these people seriously.
That's correct. I never dismiss what people say when they're given a platform. I think one of the things we have to be careful is not to give them a bigger platform, and that a comment that would be seen by relatively few not be exploited and given much greater exposure. But I do think that it's something I certainly take seriously. Others have, that we've looked into it, and we will have to see what can be done. Unfortunately, in America, we don't have libel laws like in Europe. You would be able to bring a lawsuit.
Or fortunately, right.
But we don't have the same laws. So he has the right to speak, but we also have the right to make sure he doesn't get a platform to speak.
Right, and that's why folks could certainly be in touch with those who put him on TV to make these statements and to make those arguments. And there's plenty on the web if people want to find out how to respond from the usual websites that provide good information about that. All right, so the polls in Israel. I mean, first of all, the Labor Likud thing. I never understand the advantage of making statements like we will not form a coalition with Likud before the election. Why does a leader of labor have to do that? Isn't it better to leave all options open?
One would think, and in most circumstances, it's probably true. But this election is now getting into the phase that we predicted, where statements would be made. It happens here too. And allegations and reports of comments, sometimes out of context, sometimes in context. I think that she regrets making the comment, Yachimovich, right now, because the reaction obviously was negative to it.
Right.
Because nobody anticipates that she's going to win, and to say that she would rather remain the leader of the opposition and close the door on the prospect of being part of a government when she doesn't know how the numbers will break down or how they will, how the negotiations will go once the election is over, that it shows that many of the people there are political novices, and they are not, they have no real background in politics. She was a reporter, and she's smart, but doesn't make her a good politician. You saw with Naftali Bennett,
the right
comment that he has had to walk back now constantly, even though his numbers remain strong, and Labor's numbers are strong, but no basis to assume that either they could lead a government or be a dominant part of the opposition. It could be the lead party with the largest number of seats at 16, but that's certainly not the Labor of old. And we see the other parties, Kadima is still wavering between 0 and 2. We see the others, the numbers go up and down. But it will become much more intense because you're really fighting over a very small number of votes. Because most voters are committed already, the hardcore, to each of the parties. And you could have a shift by virtue of somebody's comments. You could have a shift by virtue of an attack. Or some people are trying to differentiate themselves. It's Tzipi Livni, who just started a new party, said that if she doesn't have a significant position, she will drop out again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why would anybody vote for her?
Right. It doesn't make sense.
Saying, you vote for me, but if I don't get what I want, I'm leaving.
And you think that the Yakimovich thing will hurt her numbers?
I think, well, she's...
I mean the real
back,
numbers.
But,
I mean,
we'll walk it back, but
right,
already even in the press, which
right
is, not right-leaning, was critical of her.
Well, what do you think of the Naftali Bennett thing? This whole phenomenon just continues. There's some polls that have him at 18 seats this morning.
That's true, and BB 34, 32, 30.
Right.
I think, again, it's a fluid situation, and that what's interesting is that he's attracting young people, not Orthodox, not right-wing even necessarily.
Right.
People are looking for an alternative. It could be a protest vote, and it could be something that they say now, but when they actually get into voting booths, they go back to their traditional affiliation.
Well, that goes back to what you just said a few minutes ago in terms of the numbers that have already, that are hardcore, they know exactly who they're voting for already. Where would you put that number? If you had, I know you don't like predictions, but this is a pretty easy one. Where would you put it between 0 and 100? What percentage of Israeli voters likely know today who they will be voting for? Is it over 90%?
I would say it's probably 80 to 90%.
Wow.
Are fixed. First of all, older people have long-time associations, so they vote. But
right,
the shakeup of the parties now, broke a lot of the traditional connections and ties. It was often, you know, children voted in the same party as their families, et cetera. This is not true anymore when you have so many parties in such a fluid situation. You see Shas going up and down a few seats, but it's always within a range. And even with BB was up to as high as 40 at one point, the Likud Beitenu combination.
Remember those days?
I'm sure he does.
Fondly.
But what he wants is, as long as he's the major party, he can build coalitions. But, you know, he's come out very tough against Bennett, as has Shas, because they see them taking away votes. So they're trying to win back those who are marginally affiliated with Bennett, but could be swung back. So, again, it's a fight over a small vote, as it was here. Over
yeah,
a relatively small number
that's
compared
true.
To the larger universe.
And that became more and more obvious the closer we got to the election. All right, I have a feeling I know your answer on this. I think it's important to reiterate because you've commented millions of times about this type of tactic. When you see an ad in Israel that puts Naftali Bennett behind barbed wire and has Holocaust images used in the ad campaign, I'm sure you consider that a bad idea.
It's offensive. And certainly in Israel it should be, it is offensive. There are laws about mocking or denying the Holocaust. I would tell those who did it to look at what's happening in Iran, where they are again going to have a competition for Holocaust cartoons to mock and denigrate the Shoah.
Oh, boy.
And if you remember, in 2006, he did it. He did the same thing, Ahmadinejad, and he had the... he took the convention center, a large facility, to have the exhibition, and less than 50 people a day came to it. So the people of Iran don't engage in this and by and large reject it, but you see the characterizations, even reports now of Morsi, the president of Egypt, characterizing Jews as children of apes and pigs in the traditional reference, those reports coming from Al-Quds, where he supposedly did two interviews and made these references, but that should really be an alert and a warning about the kind of images, and people think that it's, you know, they're trying to convey a message. There are better ways to do it.
Oh, that's for sure. When is that his election? When's the end of that Ahmadinejad's term already?
In June.
June is the election. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program. Heard and listen to sponsor WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. Around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Rabbi Yudin's going to join us at 8:15 from Israel today. He'll speak to us about the Torah portion from the Holy Land. Ding, before the end of our broadcast today, will join us for a Hask update, so we'll do that coming up. And don't forget again, Monday, one of the most influential pollsters in Israel is going to be joining us live via telephone from Israel. And Tuesday morning, Naftali Bennett himself is going to be checking in here at JM in the AM. What does Iran mean when they say they want now to deal on the nuclear issue? Is this any type of progress that they would not have come to the table earlier and now they're willing to?
No, this is something that they keep postponing and postponing, and they use it to gain time. There is no indication that they're prepared to accept any kind of a serious deal. There are many people who feel that there should be a proposal put on the table as a take-it-or-leave-it final gesture and to enable the parties to say, look, we went the extra mile, we've done everything possible. Clearly he doesn't want it. I think that Khamenei has made clear that he has no interest in the kind of deal that could be acceptable. There are people saying we should put forward proposals that they can enrich up to 5% and no more, and that they have to allow full inspections, etc. And so far he has said he rejects it.
So every time they make a statement about we're ready to meet, they never say what they're willing to concede or what they're willing to meet about?
Well, their agendas, but no, they don't talk about what they're ready to accept. And the key here is that the West has to show clearly that there is a deadline, that this is not open-ended negotiations, as many leaders, even from the United States, have said. It has to be clear there's a deadline, and after which we will not have further extensions. When we look at how aggressive Iran has become, you know, the president signed legislation this past week, the Countering Iran in the Western Hemisphere, which really takes notice of something we've talked about for years, about how far they have infiltrated and how far they've extended the network of both Hezbollah and Iran's contacts. They've opened six embassies in Latin American countries in the last 5-6 years. They've opened more than a dozen cultural centers, which are anything but a cultural center. We know the reports that came out in the last few days about Mexico, again, a subject you know, you and I have discussed here for a long time, and I was always shocked that nobody would pay attention to it, but we know that they're tied to the narco-terrorism. We know that the reports about their efforts to tunnel under the American border, to use the same tactics they use in Gaza. The Mexican story, which we've talked about for a long time, which is it's really very important because, you know, it's not a hypothetical danger. It's a real danger right here on our borders, and they have partners in the drug cartels. There are 200,000 Syrians and Lebanese immigrants, most of them illegally living in Mexico. It involves money laundering and narcotics. The ties that they're showing how they were responsible for the killing of Hariri and their role destabilizing Syria, and the information that has come up is really quite serious. So people, you know, for some reason, Iran goes on a back burner because of other things, the economic, the cliff, the elections here, and we know that they have been moving ahead all the time. There's been a lessening, let's say, in their supplies to Hamas and Hezbollah because of the situation in Syria and some drain because of the impact of sanctions, which internally is really causing a problem. People haven't been paid for many months, etc. But you see that they continue to arm Syria. They are moving ahead in aggressive actions with this naval exercise in the Straits. The report about how they hijacked the Bahrain uprising, which really started, they say, with some democratic aspirations, but then Hezbollah and Iran took it over. And read what the other Arabs, what the Gulf states, these others are saying, and the infiltration into the fighting in Syria by Iran and their role there, and Hezbollah direct involvement, plus the destabilizing impact on Lebanon.
Yeah, we'll get to Syria in a minute. By the way, you just gave me a good idea. We should take the term that supposedly really had a major effect in this country, the fiscal cliff, and we should create a term for Washington called the nuclear cliff.
The Iran cliff, right.
Yeah, because we're about
to fall over.
Because we may go over the nuclear cliff very soon.
Yeah, let's hope Khamenei and Ahmadinejad go over the cliff and finally... But
and by the way,
because of the internal election also there,
right.
Some of the same things we talked about, you know, were there... There are real splits. Ahmadinejad has his candidate, but it's getting they're escalating the rhetoric. Ahmadinejad and the Iran Revolutionary Guard had a really vicious public fight over the economy and over everything else.
Do you agree that the immediate action or near immediate actions of our president after Inauguration Day is going to be very important? That it's possible that he'll utilize that opportunity of having been sworn in for a second term to finally take real action or announce real action against Iran, or we shouldn't expect that?
Well, real actions are being taken in terms of the sanctions, but he won't announce real action if the, quote, real action is to take place. I hope it just happens and we find about it later. But the what's important is that the Iranians believe that real action is possible.
Will Iran be in his inauguration speech? I wonder.
That's a good question. I think it would be hard to imagine, unless the speech is really just about domestic affairs, and then he uses, you know, the State of the Union speech to address that.
Oh, that's true, right.
Foreign affairs,
right.
Which generally in his speeches, foreign affairs have not been a central focus.
But he does have the State of the Union to fall back on, that's true. Right, you mentioned Syria a moment ago. So the statistics now is that this civil war has cost 60,000 lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
And no reason to believe that's not accurate, right?
Right.
And now, not to get philosophical here, because I'm asking this as a practical question as well, who better than we as a people can relate to tens of thousands or more being killed in any type of action? And the world essentially, you know, standing by and not being willing to intervene much. Do these numbers start to scare world powers into figuring that they have to intervene in the Syrian civil war?
Look, certainly we're sensitive to the fact that the latest report showing 60,000 dead, according to the UN, and saying that there could be even more, and the destruction, et cetera, that comes with it. But the international community's failure to respond is dangerous in because of the precedent that it sets, the message it sends to terrorists that you can get away with anything and everything, that you can have mass murder taking place, and the West is, and the international community are impotent to really act, because you can have countries like Russia or China or others hold out, as we even have in regard to Iran. And there are reports now of the use of paralyzing chemical agents coming from international sources, not the domestic. The Scuds, it seems, were used against army bases that were being taken by rebel forces, and they wanted to prevent them from getting some of the heavy equipment, missiles, etc. The fighting is certainly very intense, close to Damascus. They're bombing even just this morning again. And Assad appears to be more and more isolated. And yet Russia, which says that they recognize his days are over, said we will oppose any intervention, we'll oppose UN sanctions. Putin sees the end of it, but he wants to show that he stood by till the end, even though there's a lot of internal reaction to it. And even the Aleppo airport had to be closed because of the fighting. The suburbs of Damascus have been seen some very heavy fighting, especially a place called Daraa, which is right near a very important strategic base. And we see that amongst the groups that are emerging, more and more are group, we've talked about al-Nusra and another group, both of them have numerous fighters who actually come out of a program in Egypt where there's a year-long program to train Islamic preachers. So you have guys from Pakistan, Tajikistan, Libya, etc., coming there, and the battle in Syria is actually becoming more and more a battle between Sunni and Shiites, as we warned, and has broader regional implication. For both Iran and Russia, is fall obviously will be a major blow, so anything that's a blow to Iran, people like, but we have to think about the day after. And right now, there does not appear to be any leader who emerges. The interesting thing is that I saw a report that both Syria and Hezbollah will not intervene if Israel attacks Iran. So they're trying to distance themselves on the one hand. We don't know what will actually happen in the circumstance.
That would mean likely that there are secret talks taking place between Israel and those countries.
Well, let's say secret warnings that are very clear. Also, it's because of their diminished capacity. And the Hezbollah knows that an attack would lead to a devastating response this time, as opposed to last, because now they are part of the government, they're part of the infrastructure. There are people who argue it, by the way, that should have been the response in Gaza, that Gaza, we weren't fighting a terrorist organization, you now have a terrorist state.
Right.
Today, hundreds of thousands of people turned out to this Fatah-sponsored demonstration.
Right.
And look at the language and the things that they're saying there.
Right, they certainly are acting like they're under a national banner, so they should be treated that way.
That's right. And then, you know, the restrictions of hitting infrastructure, things like that, would be removed.
Malcolm, I know, for those of us who don't have your background, history, political science, etc., what is the simple answer, if there is one, to how Assad has survived all this?
Well, first of all, he has an incredible infrastructure, intelligence, military, so many people involved in the army, had a large standing army, which is greatly diminished. And there's nothing that motivates somebody more than survival. And the people who are fighting for him now are the Alawites, Christian Sunnis, who fear that they will be massacred. And it's a message they keep giving them, that if he falls, and as you know, I've said this often, he told this to me personally when I met him 2 years ago, before the fighting started in Syria, that if what happened in Egypt ever happened to him, he could not do what Mubarak did and step down, because the Alawites will be massacred.
Wow.
And so the options open to him are either to flee, as his family is gone, or but there would be the generals and others would hold him back from doing that, or to try to make a deal, or to retreat to an Alawite enclave. But he is not. He's going to fight, and from the very first day of the fighting, I said it will be determined by the fall of Damascus and Aleppo. You can fight all over. They can control 70% of the country. Aleppo and Damascus are the key.
Right.
That's why he's fighting so viciously against them in the suburbs of Damascus, because once if the Damascus situation changes dramatically, that will be the end.
And when you have standoffs like this, that's why tens of thousands end up getting killed.
And exactly. And you have the added element of the chemical weapons, which he has supposedly weaponized and has these mobile centers, which he may take with him to isolated places if he goes into this enclave so that he can protect the people. And remember, you're talking about a couple million people being involved in this. We see him in Tartus. We see him in the mountain region where the Alawites have large concentrations. In the meantime, the Kurds are asserting their own independence in their region, their areas, both in Syria and now towards the Iraqi border. That's a factor that we can't deal now, but it's certainly something for the future to consider.
JM in the AM, Rabbi Yudin's going to join us from the Holy Land in just a few minutes. Malcolm, didn't the New York Times, especially for those who listen to this weekly update every week and have heard your comments about what goes on between Israel and Gaza in terms of construction items, etc., didn't the New York Times make too big of a deal about how finally Israel has decided to allow construction items into Gaza?
Well, it is a significant concession because the concern, this is...
So when you always tell us that this is happening on a regular basis, it just was not to this volume?
No, it was building materials are always allowed to go into sponsored projects, and meaning from international organizations, so that it wouldn't be used to build missile silos and reinforce bunkers, etc.
Right.
Now it's being allowed in for private construction.
That's a new development.
Pardon me?
And that's a new development.
That is a new development, although, as you know, and it's supposedly part of the negotiations in exchange for which Egypt is supposed to do more to prevent the weapons smuggling, and supposedly they stopped two shipments from the Sudan and one from Libya and Iran coming into Gaza. But we know the smuggling's continuing. They did close some of the tunnels, but they're continuing, and Egypt itself was allowing in construction material in a limited way. They don't, haven't opened up the borders either, because they're so focused internally, I think, right now, and his crackdown on the media and et cetera, what's going on inside Egypt, and the divisions after the vote on the Constitution. So the situation in Gaza itself should be something that gets much more focus, and this is... they let in 20 truckloads of building materials, is a significant change in policy. But you see that they ban journalists who cooperate with Israeli media. This is something that doesn't exist anywhere else. You see the demonstrations, these huge demonstrations, and the solidarity missions. There are, I think, 130 solidarity visits to Gaza that brought them 5,000 tourists. So tourists,
meaning from Egypt?
From all over the Arab world.
Wow.
That people came, like Abdul, we did our solidarity visit, so they came after the war to pay. And there's no doubt that Hamas has gotten a boost in the aftermath of the pillar of defense.
Right. With that in mind, does it frustrate you when the president of Israel talks about negotiating directly with Hamas?
There were several things that he said that I think were surprising and sometimes perhaps not completely thought through. There are very few people who today would advocate negotiations with Hamas as long as they continue to the policies and look at the speeches that they give, their growing power in the West Bank and influence amongst the Palestinians. It shows that they would win in an election. We don't know how that would actually play out.
I don't
think they really want to live under Hamas situation, and especially the Palestinian NGOs that show how the PA has tortured 96% of the 14,000 people they arrested between 2007 and 2011, I think they said, and then people killed, the Arab media being restricted, but now telling more stories about Palestinian war crimes based on the pictures that Israel was able to show. And if you look at how East Jerusalem Arabs are flocking to come to Israel, they call it the Israelization or normalization. There are 10 universities in East Jerusalem preparing Arab students for Israeli universities to be able to take the matriculation exams. And more of them are in institutions, more of them, more building requests, more volunteering for national service.
Unbelievable.
And even though that sometimes they have to do it clandestinely, but they do. And yet, what does the whole world focus on? They condemn, the British government condemns making Ariel a university rather than a college and calls that an impediment to peace. I want to see somebody tell me how a university that has many Arab students, how is this an impediment to peace? The best line I saw was Gideon Saar, the minister, former minister of education. He said to the British, he said, you know, I think our connection is at least as close as yours is to the Falklands. it's a school with 14,000 students. Why this becomes the focus, and we talked about the failure to react on Syria, the threats of all kinds of the repercussions, because you made it a university.
But that's why I want to stress when we talk about, because thank God we have the comforts and luxury of this world, wherever people have the opportunity to live in a free part of the world, and we often think that this stuff doesn't go on anymore, and it's happening every single day. That was the point of me bringing up Harris before. Like, it just, people have to realize that this stuff is going on constantly.
Constantly, and the problem is that we become inured to it. The whole debate over E1. Anybody who's been there knows that this is rocks. These are barren land, no inhabitants, and yet they threaten sanctions over it. They talk about it in such exaggerated terms. You know, the Saudis arrested 41 guests that were coming to a house because they were plotting a Christmas celebration.
Hmm.
Because they banned Christmas celebrations. The crackdown against Christian groups, and we see that Christians going to the West Bank for celebrations, dozens of them asked to move to Israel, as of many others, and we see the persecution of Christian groups and Christians across the Middle East. Does that get this kind of attention, these condemnations? No. And this absurdity that is developed, but people become too dismissive of it. The delegitimization campaign is going on. You see it when the University of Toronto graduate students, not a big number, but they voted to divest. We see more and more places with pressure on entertainers not to go to Israel.
People, right,
can say this is marginal. It's not marginal. It's the first steps. It means that they ban them, and then they ban Israelis from other things and Jews, and we see that it grows in its scope.
No question about it. Finally, the Hegel thing is not officially dead, right? He's not made a decision about what to do with
that. Not dead at all. I would say that it's still, the very fact that an announcement that was supposed to have happened
right.
this week was put off, it was either because of the economic cliff and he didn't want to have another divisive issue.
You've
seen more of the articles, but you also see the campaign against Michelle Flournoy about why she would not be able to because of her children. I would say absolutely this issue is not dead.
All right.
By the way, there is
yeah.
good news that Israel's topped 8 million people. Its economy grew 3.3%, which is best in the West, even though it's slower than the last few years. And Israeli doctors treated President Obama's grandmother in a hospital in Equatorial Guinea. We have an Israeli-run hospital. And she came from Kenya to have an operation on her eyes.
Does he know that they were Israeli doctors?
I'm not sure.
You got to tell him next time you see him.
I don't know how close he is to his grandmother.
Unbelievable. Malcolm, fantastic. 18 days away from the election, Malcolm.
Next Friday's report will be from the Holy Land.
Oh, fantastic. So we'll speak to you'll have a lot more information on the election. All right, we'll speak to Malcolm from Israel. He'll be in Israel next Friday, please God, right here at JM in the AM.